Hi, everyone. My name is Ryan Sheriff, and I'm a research associate at the Center for Housing Policy. I'd like to welcome everyone to this housingpolicy.org Live at the Forum event. This is the fourth event of our third annual Housing Solutions Week, and if you're not familiar with Housing Solutions Week, this is a week-long event in which the Center for Housing Policy and the National Housing Conference host a series of events focusing on high-impact solutions to solving the nation's affordable housing challenges. For today's Live at the Forum event, we're introducing a new online toolkit on housingpolicy.org that's focused on making homes more resistant to natural disasters. And in addition, I have some experts on disaster-resistant housing with me today who will be discussing programs and resources both at the federal and state level that help make residents and homes safer in disaster-prone areas. Before I give a brief overview of the new toolkit and introduce the speakers, I'd like to quickly review the logistics of how this event will work. So for the next 25 minutes or so, you'll hear from me and our guests about policies, programs, and resources for making homes more resistant to natural disasters. Then for the 90 minutes following that call, our guests and I will be online answering your questions on the housingpolicy.org forum. At the end of the call, I'll give some additional instructions about how to access and log into the forum. But for those of you who are trying to post questions during this call, if you run into any technical problems, my colleague here at the center, Rebecca Cohen, is available to help you. And you can reach her at 202-466-2121, extension 236, or you can email her at rcohen@nhc.org. So now I'd like to give you a brief overview of our new toolkit on housingpolicy.org, which focuses on making homes more resistant to natural disasters. So many of the programs and resources that are currently available and related to housing and natural disasters target disaster recovery. That's rebuilding and relocation of homes and communities after a disaster has occurred. The Center for Housing Policy, in collaboration with our sponsor for this project, Weather Predict Consulting, we wanted to create a toolkit that provides information on more proactive measures to protect residents in their homes from disasters. And we also wanted to highlight programs and resources that support and encourage such measures at the federal, state, and local levels. So just to give you an idea where the toolkit's located, there's a link to the toolkit at the bottom of the post for this event on the housingpolicy.org forum. And you can also link to it from the toolbox section of housingpolicy.org. That's the green tab at the top of the housingpolicy.org homepage or any page in housingpolicy.org. So the toolkit is divided into four policy sections. The first section provides an overview of the techniques and materials and tools that households, builders, and contractors can use to make homes more resilient to the hazards posed by natural disasters. And these are things like floods, high winds, and heavy rains. The section also discusses what state and local governments can do to promote home disaster resistance and provide training for residents and for professionals. The second policy section focuses on what can be done at the community level to protect residents and their homes from natural disasters. So this explores how to better design and enforce residential building codes and also how to develop and implement better land use planning strategies that promote safer residential development. The third section outlines existing and potential resources to finance and incentivize disaster-resistant home construction improvements. And this is both at the federal and local, state and local levels. And also, this financing section has a particular focus on lower-income families, as they will usually have more trouble in paying for these types of upgrades to make their homes safer. And the fourth section discusses the linkages between home disaster resistance and energy efficiency. And in this section, we highlight research on these linkages between those two areas, technologies and materials that serve both goals, and programs that finance and incentivize efforts to make homes safer and greener. In addition to this toolkit, we've also developed 3 issue briefs that highlight the main topics in the toolkit. And there's a link to these briefs at the bottom of the post for this event on the forum. And you can also find the issue briefs in the key resources page at the end of each of those 4 policy sections I just described if you're actually on looking at the new toolkit. And we've also created a new discussion group on our online housingpolicy.org forum that's dedicated to housing and natural disasters. And this is where the online Q&A session following this call is going to take place. So we hope you'll go take a look at the toolkit. And I'd like to go ahead now and introduce the other speakers on the call. So our first speaker is Leslie Chapman Henderson. She's president and CEO of the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting disaster safety and property mitigation laws. Leslie has substantial experience working with states and localities and organizations across the country to help promote, support, and educate on disaster-resistant construction methods. And today she's going to give us a basic overview of disaster-resistant construction and talk about some relevant work that's being done at the state and local levels. After that, Ann Robertson is going to speak. She's manager of the South Carolina Hurricane Damage Mitigation Program, which is commonly known as the SC Safe Home Program. And this program, which was established in 2007, offers grants to state residents to protect their homes from the damaging effects of hurricanes and other severe storms. Ann's going to talk about the SC Safe Home Program and how it successfully supported home disaster resistance in South Carolina. And then finally, Mike Cohen will speak. He's Vice President of Government Affairs at Renaissance Re, which is a global provider of reinsurance and insurance to cover the risk of natural and man-made catastrophes. Mike's actually been working with us very closely on the development of this online toolkit and the other related resources. And he's going to talk about federal-level resources to support disaster-resistant homes and some current initiatives to help augment those federal resources. So I'd like to turn it over now to our first speaker, Leslie, to continue our discussion.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It's a pleasure to be here, and it is always something that we never miss an opportunity to work with the universe of providers and folks dedicated to affordable housing, because we know to fulfill our mission of strengthening homes and safeguarding families that we have to get it right in affordable housing. So what I thought I would do today, before I turn everyone listening into a structural engineer, just kidding, I thought I'd tackle some of the myths that exist around affordable housing and disaster mitigation. In particular, today I was going to talk about some of the experiences we've had with hurricane and high wind mitigation, which is predominantly on hurricane, obviously, in the hurricane zones, but across the country, high wind mitigation and making homes safe from high wind is a very simple, straightforward structural approach. So I thought I'd start by debunking the first myth that we engaged or heard about years ago when we first started engaging with groups that help provide affordable housing and all the support services to those residents, and that was that disaster mitigation, in particular in the hurricane zones, is a nice to have, that having a house that's strong enough to survive a hurricane is not a realistic goal for affordable housing stakeholders because it's simply too expensive. And when we dug into this absolute myth, we realized that it's just simply a failure to understand how fundamental some of the construction practices are that can make all the difference in survival. So I thought I'd share a quick anecdote about Hurricane Andrew in 1992. I worked in a response capacity during Hurricane Andrew and looked at hundreds of thousands of records and individually hundreds of homes after that storm. It was a very interesting situation that cropped up where some of the commercial residences were completely destroyed and totally failed in the high wind event of Hurricane Andrew. It was a Category 5 hurricane. Adjacent to one of the commercial residential areas was a community built with 100% volunteer labor, and I believe it was a Habitat. Well, we saw this situation again and again. The one in particular was a Habitat community, all built with volunteer labor. Nothing fancy or expensive, no special techniques or anything else other than the fact that the volunteers were very careful to make sure all the nails got into the roofing framework when they were putting it together. So the storm came along, and a commercially developed arena of homes was flattened, but the habitat homes stood and survived intact. They had very little, if any, just a tiny bit of cosmetic damage, a couple shingles moved here and there. And when the engineering assessments took place, what they realized it was just simply a matter of a handful of additional nails that kept the roofs on those houses and kept them intact. So the Miami Herald put out a headline that said, Habitat 24, Andrew 0, like a football score. And what the message was is, you know, all homes can be made to be disaster resistant and can survive, and it isn't too expensive. And we take it a step further. We say that houses to be affordable, you know, is one thing, but if you look at the time horizon of home ownership, they cannot become disposable. So it's not just about what a house costs when you buy it, it's what it costs when you lose it. So that's one of the big myths around this, and that's why we're so committed to working with you all and look forward to expanding this relationship. The other piece to that, and I'll touch quickly on some of the techniques, I've already talked a little bit about the roofing piece, is that this is just too complicated, and that you know, making a home more disaster resistant is just too complicated that ordinary people can't even begin to understand it. And again, that's simply not the case. In our experience, what we've done throughout our history, and I want to urge all of you to take advantage of our free resources, which some of which I think will come through this new toolkit and also at our website, flash.org, because they're all backed by free information from experts. But if you look at the two main things, again, going to high wind, you can keep the roof on a house and you can keep the openings protected. You will win when the high winds come, and your house will survive, and the families will be safe inside. So we essentially break down this not complicated way of approaching construction, either on a new home or on a retrofit, by looking at two basic areas of the house. One is the roof, and the kinds of things that can be done differently are slightly thicker decking over the roof framing that's got a little bit more you know, resilience because of it's a little thicker. We recommend a 5/8 plywood CDX decking, for example, versus a 3/4 inch strand board, which is the you know, manufacturer. We also recommend a stronger nailing pattern in the roof. And then we recommend things like putting down strips, very affordable, of what's called peel and stick or peel and seal, which is simply a strip that goes over the joints that are purposefully left in the roof decking so that the roof deck can expand and contract. What the peel and stick does is it provides a secondary water barrier once the rains come, inevitably, if you lose roof covering. As for roof covering or for shingles, tile, metal, et cetera, this is another place where people often think you have to spend a lot of money get a wind-resistant roof, not necessarily. So many improvements have been made in roof covering materials, asphalt being the most common, of course, that we now have high wind and impact-rated shingles that are available for a marginal increase in cost. So I think when you look at the roof, which is a big part one, the main point is that we need to be thinking about the opportunity time. If you're building a home or if you're re-roofing a home, that's the time to insert mitigation in there. The other big piece, very quickly, is just to address the openings around the structure. And there's a whole range of ways to do that. And when I say openings, I mean entry doors, windows, garage doors, even skylights and attic vents need to be addressed. But the marketplace has a wide range of affordable products that are out there. And what we do every day is work with homeowners who are looking for things. So I think my time is expiring. I want to wrap up by saying that this is also not something that is simply for single-family homes. Multifamily structures have an advantage in terms of the overall structural strength because they're built under commercial building codes. Oftentimes, the only thing between the multifamily structure, if it's built to a modern code, and a wind-resistant unit is some type of opening protection for that individual unit. The trick is that you have to get all the units protected, and that becomes a challenge. But it's, you know, you're halfway there in a multifamily structure if it's built to a modern code, because it's been developed under commercial requirements, which require engineered and stamped plans, and oftentimes are much sturdier out of the gate. So I think that's it for me. I'm going to wrap up and then stand by for questions online.
Thanks, Leslie. And I'd like to turn it over to Ann Robertson now.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and I thank you for inviting South Carolina to the discussion. As a result of South Carolina's risk of catastrophic exposure, some insurers have been unable to expand their writings due to lack of capacity. And in response to this, the South Carolina General Assembly passed the Omnibus Coastal Property Insurance Reform Act of 2007, which Ryan alluded to earlier. The act called for changes to our Wind and Hail Underwriting Association, which is our residual market. It encouraged mitigation through consumer initiatives and grants through the South Carolina Safe Home Program, as well as the aggressive recruitment of insurers to the coastal property market. With this three-pronged approach, we've been able to maintain a relatively stable coastal market. And in fact, other coastal states are incorporating various sections of our legislation into their laws and regulations. And while the 2007 reforms have helped to ensure access to coastal property insurance coverage, mitigation continues to be the best long-term solution. Mitigation through building code enforcement, the construction of storm-resistant buildings, and better land use planning is the best way to reduce a state's risk of loss due to coastal exposure. Only by reducing this catastrophic loss exposure will we be able to stabilize the cost of property insurance coverage. To be successful, coastal states must continue to invest and encourage an effective mitigation strategy. We know that mitigation saves lives and that a retrofitted home is easier to insure in the voluntary market. SC Safe Home and programs like it stress the benefits of a more resilient infrastructure with buildings designed to withstand hurricane damage. Buildings constructed and retrofitted to higher standards help ease the demand for state and federal post-disaster funding, reduce the losses to state and local governments, as well as FEMA and the federal government. SC Safe Home provides a comprehensive and coordinated approach to strengthening and fortifying homes against natural disasters. We distribute grant funds limited up to $5,000 per home by way of matching and non-matching grants. And an eligible homeowner is awarded a matching or non-matching grant based upon their personal income compared with the median annual income based upon the HUD standards and the value of their home. For matching grants, the homeowner's money is matched dollar for dollar if the value of the home does not exceed $300,000. And for non-matching grants, the value of the home may not exceed $150,000. To date, SC Safe Home has received more than 1,930 grant applications and has awarded more than 1,050 grants totaling $4.3 million to help retrofit and strengthen homes located in our coastal counties. The program has and continues to make an important economic impact to the coastal communities by creating jobs in the construction and home improvement industries. This has been stated before, I believe I've seen it on the website, but for every dollar spent on mitigation, society saves $4 in potential losses and reconstruction costs, according to FEMA. Based on this information, SC Safe Home has reduced the potential loss and future reconstruction costs from a hurricane or severe wind event by more than $16 million. Data received from the grant program has indicated that the average age of the home retrofitted through the program is 27 years old, and the average value of the home receiving the retrofit award is $91,000. Approximately 65% of our applicants have qualified as low-income applicants. As Leslie indicated, science indicates that the single most effective mitigation measure a homeowner can make to their home is the replacement of the roof with a stronger, safer roofing system. 76% of our grantees have selected to replace their roof with a stronger system. Homeowners that have selected to replace their windows with impact-resistant systems and hurricane shutters have also reported, on average, a 29% savings in their energy costs. I think that's an important point to bring up, especially as we move forward and look at some of the federal initiatives that are on the horizon. Structures retrofitted through SC Safe Home are more attractive risk to insurance companies. Homeowners have reported a premium reduction savings of up to 24% from their insurance carriers. SC Safe Home requires contractors and wind inspectors working with the program to be trained and tested by the Federal Alliance of Safe Home, FLASH, Leslie's organization, through the Blueprint for Safety and Training program. To date, there are more than 80 certified inspectors and 65 certified contractors working with the program. SC Safe Home and the Department of Insurance are committed to mitigation and continue to spread the word of this important life and money-saving information through various methods of outreach, be it hurricane mitigation expos, educational classes for insurance producers, realtors, code enforcement officers, floodplain managers, and others, or through events such as the forum today. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and welcome any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ann. And we'd like to close out with Mike.
Sure. Thanks, Ryan. And I think Leslie and Ann have both painted a good picture of why it's so important to be doing hazard mitigation. And while I think some states like South Carolina and Florida have embraced it, the federal level has still been kind of slow going. And even though we have that statistic that FEMA actually developed, which is that a dollar spent on mitigation saves society an average of $4, it still is, I would say, tough sledding at the federal level, although I think we're making progress. And I think one of the reasons it's been difficult in the past at the federal level is, if you've ever read the book The Black Swan, which is, I would tentatively recommend it, it's on risk, but he gives an interesting analogy in there. He talks about September 11th, and he said, what if there had been a prescient congressman who 5 years before September 11th had said, I have this vision that planes are going to be flying into the World Trade Center the morning of September 11th, 2001. And so what I'd want to do is I want to spend $50 billion on hardening cockpits of planes, on putting in additional security at airports, on tightening up immigration standards and passports, and spending all of this money to do that. And everything, he manages to get Congress to pass this. The terrorists are averted. And on the morning of September 11th, he stands in front of the World Trade Center and says, look what I've done. Look what we've all done together. These buildings are still here. Nothing's happening. There's no planes flying into these buildings. And I think the response from the general public and virtually everybody would be, this guy's crazy. I mean, how do you prove that nothing happened and that nothing happened because of what you did? And that's, I think, the dilemma we have with hazard mitigation. If we had spent tens of billions of dollars reinforcing the levees in New Orleans years in advance of Hurricane Katrina, and therefore they had held and we hadn't seen that kind of storm damage, I think it would have been difficult for people to say, you know, that those levee repairs we did really were the difference in preventing all this damage. So for a politician, it's hard when you need to be able to stand in front of something and do a ribbon cutting and take credit for it and say, look what I did. Nothing happened. So despite that and that mentality, I think we have been making progress, certainly in the last year or two. There are a couple of bills that are now working their way through Congress that deal with mitigation in some shape or fashion. The first one is HomeStar, and this is a program you may have heard about. It's originally was referred to as Cash for Caulkers, and it's a program that the Obama administration has been pushing hard for. It's part of the jobs bill and the job strategy to create jobs over the next 6 or 8 months. And what this would do is reimburse homeowners for purchasing of energy-efficient appliances or doing weatherization projects to their homes. Now, it's still very much kind of in the drafting stage in Congress, but what we've been saying, and we being a coalition not just of my company but of environmental groups, fiscal conservatives, insurance companies, emergency management folks, have collectively come together. We call ourselves Smarter, Safer. We've been pushing for inclusion in HomeStar of hazard mitigation. And the idea there is, as far as job creation, you're doing exactly the same amount of job creation as you would for energy efficiency work. But as Ann pointed out, there's an overlap of energy efficiency and hazard mitigation, so that when you do hazard mitigation, particularly for hurricanes, you're getting the added benefit of energy efficiency. So we think it's a great twofer and a way to advance both interests. So Congress is moving. We have some champions in the Senate and in both Florida senators who are pushing for this, and they're also pushing for a similar proposal, something that actually went through the original big stimulus bill, that $787 billion package of last year, had a similar weatherization grant system where it goes through the existing weatherization program, which is the energy efficiency program that's been around for decades. About $2 or $3 billion went through that program when it normally gets about $200 million a year. So it's a huge influx of money that's been going through weatherization or trying to go through weatherization, because last time I checked, only about 10% has been spent. So, and if it's not spent by September, it gets recaptured by the Treasury. So there's a huge pool of money sitting there that needs to get spent, and it seems to us and certainly Senators Nelson and Lemieux that this is a great place to spend out some of this money, do job creation, and do hazard mitigation while also meeting the goal of energy efficiency. So those are two, I would say, related bills that are out there, but both important. Then in addition to that, Congressman Benny Thompson has been a longtime champion of mitigation, probably one of the first big proponents of it in Congress. And he's got a package of three or four bills right now that are all trying to target different parts of mitigation. One, which is H.R. 3026, looks at mitigation efforts for public housing populations. So I think part of the equation that's been missing, even in the mitigation proposals we've been seeing generally across the country, is what are we doing for multifamily housing? What are we doing for public housing, rental housing? I wouldn't say easy, but it's accessible for a single-family homeowner to do mitigation. First of all, you own the property, so you can do what you want. You can put on hurricane shutters or reinforce your doors or windows or the roof, and nobody can tell you no. That's not true in a multifamily property. And certainly in public housing, you run into the issues of it's owned by the government, or if it's a subsidized housing, it's still owned by a landlord, and you're looking at low-income people who don't have the wherewithal to do it, even if they have the legal ability to do it. So this would provide some incentives and some ability for public housing and multifamily properties to also share in some of the mitigation resources that are out there. Another bill he has would enhance the pre-disaster mitigation grant program, which is really the one existing program out there right now that does a lot of mitigation funding, and that's through FEMA. And while it's a very good program, it's both underfunded and targeted generally at large-scale community-level projects. And those are certainly important, but what this bill would do is try and also add ways to get funds to the individual level, to the small business level, to rental property level. So another way to come at it through an existing program. And then the final piece of his package would look at first responders. And first responders are very good at responding during the crisis. The question is, are there things they could be doing 2, 4, 8 years before anything happens to get themselves better prepared, to get their communities better prepared, and to look at ways that they can mitigate what's ultimately going to happen from a major disaster in advance of it actually happening. So Chairman Thompson, he chairs the Homeland Security Committee, has certainly been a great leader in this. And the other piece of legislation, I guess the last one I'll mention given the time, is the bill that's numbered H.R. 3377, which is a reauthorization of the Stafford Act. And the Stafford Act is where this pre-disaster mitigation grant resides. So this bill, or at least part of this bill, would dramatically increase the funding that runs through the pre-disaster mitigation program up to about $250 million per year. And that funding would only be available if the states are enforcing approved building codes, which is outlined in the statute. Currently, I think it's somewhere around 12 or 13 states would meet that qualification. So it's really an incentive for states to implement a stronger building code than they currently have, and then they would get this additional funding. So all of these are in play to some extent. I think the ones that look like they're moving the quickest are Homestar and the related stimulus dollar proposals. So those we're going to keep an eye on. The Senate, I think, will be moving on them in the next week or two. The House had a markup in subcommittee yesterday, actually. And lastly, just let me, again, emphasize Smarter Safer. We have a website, smartersafer.org. It's a whole host of organizations from all walks of life, all different areas of the political spectrum, but they've all come together around a couple of key points related to disasters. And certainly mitigation is first and foremost something that this coalition has been actively engaged on and trying to promote. So thanks, and I look forward to reading your questions and responding online.
Thanks a lot, Mike, and thanks again to Leslie and Ann. All three of you really helped to expand on the foundational information that we provided in the new toolkit. So in just a few minutes, we're going to move on to the second portion of the event where you get to ask us questions, and this will take place online on the housingpolicy.org forum in our new Housing and Natural Disasters discussion group. But first, I just want to highlight a few other events that the Center and NHC have held so far during Housing Solutions Week and tell you about our final event coming up tomorrow. On Tuesday, we released an updated version of our online interactive database called Paycheck to Paycheck, which presents wage information for more than 60 occupations and home prices and rents for more than 200 metropolitan areas. And this tool really helps to gauge housing affordability for working families in different occupations across the U.S. Yesterday, we hosted two webinars introducing other new resources and tools that the Center put out. The first presented another online toolkit on housingpolicy.org that was developed in collaboration with AARP, which addresses ways to meet the housing needs of older adults. And the second webinar demonstrated new data tools available on foreclosureresponse.org, which is our website focused on resources for preventing foreclosures and stabilizing neighborhoods. And tomorrow, we'd like to invite you to join us at 1 p.m. Eastern as we release two new papers on coordinating housing, transportation, and workforce policies. And these papers were developed by the Center along with the Metropolitan Planning Council, and they feature some on-the-ground examples from practitioners in Atlanta and the Twin Cities who will be speaking as part of that event. And for more information on this upcoming event and the prior events, please visit housingpolicy.org and look for the Housing Solutions Week link that's under the highlights section there on the homepage. So now getting back to the online Q&A portion of today's event, which again is going to take place on the housingpolicy.org forum. For those of you who aren't familiar with the forum, it's the interactive portion of our housingpolicy.org and foreclosureresponse.org websites. You can access the forum by clicking on the forum tab at the top of either one of those websites, or you can go to it directly by visiting www.forum.housingpolicy.org. So we've set up a dedicated discussion thread for Q&A, which you'll find by clicking on the yellow banner at the top of the forum homepage, or if you scroll down, you'll see the Housing and Natural Disasters discussion group about halfway down on the page. And then you'll see a link for the Live at the Forum discussion on the discussion homepage there. So while anyone can view the questions and answers, you need to be a forum member to add a question of your own. So if you're new to the forum, just click on the orange sign-up link that's in the upper right-hand corner of any page on the forum to sign up there. It only takes about a minute, and it's completely free. Then, after you do that, join the Housing and Natural Disasters discussion group by clicking on the link at the top of that discussion group page. It'll say, Join this discussion group. If you're already a member, just go ahead and sign in. Just make sure that you've already joined the Housing and Natural Disasters discussion group. And then once you've joined the Natural Disasters, the Housing and Natural Disasters Discussion Group, click on the link for the Live at the Forum event. You can post any questions you have by clicking on the reply to this link that's just below the posted announcement. Now, one thing to note is that throughout the 90-minute online portion of the event, you'll need to refresh your screen every few minutes to see new questions and answers come up. They won't come up automatically. And as I mentioned earlier, my colleague Rebecca Cohen will be standing by to answer any technical questions you have. She can be reached by phone at 202-466-2121, extension 236, or you can email her at rcohen@nhc.org. And to learn more about events that are happening at the Center for Housing Policy and the National Housing Conference, please visit us at www.nhc.org. And you can also find on that website ways to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media applications. So thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you online.